So if you have a Bible, you can go ahead and turn there with me to the book of Ephesians. If you don't have a Bible, there should be one under your chair or the chair next to you. I forgot to check the page number that we're on in those Bibles today. It's Ephesians chapter 5. There's a table of contents at the beginning of those Bibles under your chair, so you can always check there if you need to find a page number. It's going to be in Ephesians chapter 5. So today we're going to have the talk, and if any of you actually were subject to having this awkward conversation with your parents at some point in life, my prayer is that this one will not be nearly as uncomfortable as that one. And if you didn't, then I guess I have a blank slate. But we're going to talk about sex, and yet sex is not the main thing we're going to talk about today, because sex isn't the main point of this passage, even though sex appears throughout the passage that we are going to be looking at today. Because the reality is, in the Bible, sex is a more of a result or a manifestation of what I talked about earlier, what we treasure, what we worship, what we love. And therefore, that is the focus of this passage and the main thing that we are going to talk about today. And this passage talks about what we treasure and what we love through the lens of light and darkness, using that imagery. And the imagery of light and darkness appears as early as the first chapter of the Bible. It says, God created the heavens and the earth, and when he created everything, when it started, it was dark, until God said, let there be light. And so throughout the Bible, darkness comes to signify a disordered, chaotic version of creation. And God's light comes to signify his creational power to bring order where there was chaos before. And yet shortly after God created the heavens and the earth, we as humans turned from him, and instead of living our lives about him and about other people, turned inward on ourselves. And much like a bright star that when it collapses in on itself creates a black hole, that is seen as a descent further and further into darkness. The deeper we go into ourselves, the further away from the light, and the further back into chaos we go. And yet it's the natural setting of all of our hearts. It's the natural thing to do to look at God and not want to build our lives around him, to want to be God of our lives instead of letting him be God of our lives. And so sex is no different. Sex follows this same trajectory. It is created by God as a good thing, created by God to be an expression and one of the most poignant expressions of physical love that we can show to one another, to be a giving thing, something I give to someone else as an expression of my love. And yet when we take it and make it ourselves, when we make it a getting thing, a way that I can get something for myself, it becomes a dark thing, a thing that leads to chaos and it starts to go sideways. And the world we live in is evidence of that. But the good news of the book of Ephesians so far has been that through trust in Christ, you go from darkness to light. That's what happens in the life of someone who trusts Jesus. But the question remains, what do you do about the fact that much of the world doesn't believe that way? What do you do about the fact that even when you become light, you're still in the midst of a lot of darkness, that the world isn't overwhelmingly characterized by this light? In fact, that's a question that's been brewing throughout the book of Ephesians, because Ephesians is all about the unity we have in Jesus. And yet that's a unity we have in Jesus. So maybe you've even wondered, if you've been with us throughout this series, okay, we've talked a lot about how we relate to each other and what that unity looks like in Christ, but how do we relate to those outside of the church, those who are not in Christ? And some of you may even be here today who that would be a description of. Well, one of our core values at City Light is mission, and we define mission as love for our neighbors. Love for those who aren't yet part of our community, who are outside of the church. And Scripture is going to very much direct us, and we're going to see in this passage that that is the posture that we are to take towards those who are not yet united to us in Jesus. It's a posture of love. And how do you do that? That's what this passage is going to answer. How do you love those outside the church? And what we're going to see is, for the sake of your neighbors, live as the light you are. That's the best way you can love the people around you. Live as the light that you now are in Christ. And today we're going to look at three ways that we do that. The first, you don't partner with the darkness. Second, remember who you are. And the third, transform the darkness. So look with me at Ephesians chapter 5. I'm going to begin reading in verse 3. Those are the smaller numbers, up through verse 14. It says, "But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you, as is proper among saints. Let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place. But instead, let there be thanksgiving. For you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure, or who is covetous, that is, an idolater, has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not become partners with them. For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true, and try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible, for anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore it says, "Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." So our passage begins with a series of prohibitions, a series of things we are not to do. And it's kind of summarized in verse 7. It says, therefore, do not become partners with them. And the "them" it's referring to is back in verse 6. It says, the sons of disobedience, which is kind of just a way of saying who we all naturally are, right? It comes naturally to us to want to run from God and build our lives on something other than Him. And that's disobedience in Scripture, to worship something that is not, in fact, God, the only worthy object of our worship. And he's saying, now that you have come out of that, now that you are a Christian, a new creation, no longer partner with those who are still living in the natural way. Now, what does it mean to partner with someone? Well, it doesn't mean totally avoid, okay, right? We're supposed to love our neighbors, those outside the church. It's not saying avoid and cut off all relationships. It's saying don't partner with them. And what I want to suggest to you is that to partner with someone is to worship what they worship, to want what they want. We use the term partner in this way often in terminology today. When you think of a law firm, for example, when someone is a partner in a law firm, they are an owner of that business, essentially. They are invested in it. And therefore, all the partners essentially are saying, we're signing up for the same thing. The success of this business is what leads to our success. And therefore, we all are after the same goal. And so to partner with someone is to have the same goals, to have the same desires. Now you say, well, where do you see that in this passage? Well, if you look back, the passage begins by talking about sexual immorality, right? So it sounds like just don't do the bad sexual things that the world around you is doing. But it quickly moves. Notice, as he's writing this, he says sexual immorality, and immediately he goes to all impurity or covetousness. And then in verse 5, when he's describing covetousness, he gives this parenthetical statement that's easy to miss, but really important. He says, anyone who is covetous can also be thought of as an idolater. Now, idolatry means to worship something God has made as though that thing is God. It's to take a part of creation and say, instead of this being a good gift from God, through which I worship Him and give thanks to Him, I take this and make it my God. And he's saying covetousness is idolatry. Now, what is covetousness? Well, covetousness is not simply wanting something. Wanting something in the Bible is totally legitimate. It's seen as totally normal that if you're hungry and you want a meal, you would desire that food. That's right functioning. But covetousness is when a desire becomes a demand. When it becomes not just, I would like this, but I must have this, and I will do anything. I will stop at nothing, even if it means disobeying God, in order to get this. What is that? That is a God. That is what it means to worship something. It's to say, this is the central object and central treasure of my life, the thing I live for. And what he is saying here is that behind our sexual immorality is covetous desires, which are idolatry. That's why partnership is wanting what others want. It's saying, I'm going to worship the same things. And the reality is, if you're worshiping something other than God, if something that He has made becomes a demand, a covetous desire, a good thing that becomes a God thing, sex is one of the most attractive ways to get it. Because sex is such a visceral, sensory, physical experience of so many of the things that we covetously desire. What do I mean? Take, for example, pleasure or comfort. If that's something you live for, pleasure and comfort's a good thing, right? Like, God created humanity. He created us as humans. He's not anti-pleasure. And comfort is a nice thing. It's nice to be able to lounge around and relax and enjoy a comfortable time in your day and to not always be working and doing something. But if you say, that's the demand, that's the thing I pursue in life, all of my life revolves around how I can build for myself the most comfortable, pleasurable life for me, sex is really attractive because it comes in and says, look, You can have a comfortable, pleasurable experience right here, right like that, on demand, at your fingertips, and it'll feel good. So when life becomes stressful, when the demands of work pick up, when things in your marriage aren't going so well, when things in your relationships aren't going well, life doesn't feel comfortable. Life doesn't feel pleasurable. Finances are tight. And there's sex, and it says, hey, look, for a moment, you could escape all of that. You could have pleasure. You could have comfort right here. You can leave it all behind and live in this world, whether that's a fantasy world in your mind, whether that's an image on a screen, whether that's a relationship with another person. It invites you in and says, here's pleasure. Here's comfort. Come take it. It could be control, right? We desire to have control of our lives so that when our lives feel out of control, at least I know I can go here. At least I know I can go to this fantasy world, this escape where I'm in control, where the people in my imagination, where the people in my relationships do all the things that I want and never say no and never make me work for it, never require anything from me. I get to be in control in this one area of my life. Sex comes in and says, you can have it. You can be in control. Don't live in that real world where you're not in control. Come over here. It seems thrilling, right? When life seems boring and mundane and my life doesn't have a sense of purpose. Here comes an illicit relationship, the forbidden fruit, the thing that you might get caught, and it feels thrilling if you go and do it because now there's something exciting. Sex comes in and says, look, you can have it. You can have it if this is your covetous desire. And that's what sex is telling you about all the different things that we covetously desire. And that's where sexual immorality in particular becomes so attractive because it says, you can have it. If you want it right here, you can have it right now. Now, if you're noticing my description of the examples that I'm giving, it sounds pretty broad, right? It sounds like I'm including a lot of different things in what counts as sexual immorality. And that's because this passage is so broad. Like, notice it doesn't get into the details of listing off, well, these are the things that are allowed as far as sexual activity goes, and these are the things that are not allowed as far as sexual activity goes, so that you can just go down the list and find your struggle on it. It uses sexual immorality broadly, and the term behind this basically refers to any kind of sexual activity that takes place outside of marriage. So sex is a good thing that God created to take place between a man and a woman in a covenant-committed relationship of marriage, where you're not just giving your body, you're giving your whole person to someone else. And so sexual immorality is anything that falls short of God's design for marriage, which means any kind of sexual activity that takes place outside of it. In fact, this passage gets even more extreme because in verse 4, it prohibits even sexual joking, right? It says, let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking. So even if you're like the type who's like, hey, I get the rules, okay, I'm going to obey the rules, but we can still talk about it in such a way that makes it sound like sexual immorality is basically fun and enjoyable, and so we laugh about it and joke about it as though that's what it is. And he's saying, even there, it should not even be named among you. And this starts to sound weird to a lot of us, right? Like, I get that. For a lot of you who are here today, especially if you haven't been around church as long or you're not even a Christian, like, this standard of no sexual activity outside of marriage, not even joking about it, like, it sounds weird, right? And I got to admit, it sounds weird to me. Like, I get the sexual immorality piece because I've heard it a lot, and then he gets to the joking, and I'm like, really, man? Like, we're not even supposed to joke about it? Like, come on. But it's because this is so different from the cultural expectation. Like, the world we live in today, the common assumption about sex that I myself held for years and that most of us hold is that sex is an appetite. It's a lot like our appetite for food. And if you're hungry, what do you need? You need to eat, right? And so it is actually repressive and potentially cruel to someone else to say to them, I know you're hungry, but you can't eat. And that's how a lot of people think of religion. Hey, you're telling all these people who have these desires for sex that they're hungry and you're not letting them have their food. That's what appetites, that's how sex is commonly viewed today. So when you talk about sex in this way, it just sounds weird. There was a Christian in the 1950s who was a professor at Oxford in England who was also a Christian named C.S. Lewis, and he used to get this objection a lot, and he had a response to it that I think is really helpful. This is what he would say. He says, you can get a large audience together for a striptease act, that is, to watch a girl undress on the stage. Now, suppose you came to a country where you could fill a theater by simply bringing a covered plate onto the stage and then slowly lifting the cover so as to let everyone see, just before the lights went out, that it contained a mutton chop or a bit of bacon. Would you not think that in that country something had gone wrong with the appetite for food? His point is, the problem isn't that we have a desire for sex. The problem is something's gone wrong with our appetite for sex. It's no longer just a desire. It's a covetous desire. It's a good thing that has become a God thing. And that's why it's never satisfied. Like, if you've ever actually tried that method of like, hey, anytime I just want sex, I'll just give myself it. Does it actually work? Has it actually satisfied you? Have you said, oh, that felt good. Next time I'll just do that same thing over again. No, it always has to be bigger. It always has to be better. It always has to be changed up. It always needs something more deviant, more perverse, something added on to make it better and better and better, because it's a desire that never is actually fulfilled. It's a desire that's promising you something that it can't actually deliver. And that's what covetous, idolatrous desires do. It's saying, I'll be God to you, and it's not God. And therefore, it never actually satisfies. Okay, maybe you still don't believe me. You still don't think covetous desires, I don't think that's what's behind all this. It just feels good. That's why people do it. Look at verse 4, okay? One more evidence I'm going to throw on the pile that idolatry is behind our sexual immorality. It says, after listing sexual immorality, impurity, covetousness, then even sexual joking, it says these are out of place, and look at what it replaces it with. It says, but instead, let there be thanksgiving. I didn't expect that. Like, when you read this passage, don't be sexually immoral, put away impurity, don't let it be named among you, don't even joke about it. Instead, let there be, and I expect to find, instead, never go near sex, never talk about it. Instead, telling filthy jokes, tell Christian jokes, tell Bible jokes, you know? Don't do that. That's not what this passage is saying, right? It's saying, instead, let there be thanksgiving. Why? Because thanksgiving is the polar opposite of idolatry. Idolatry takes a good thing God made and says, I will worship this. Thanksgiving takes a good thing God made and says, I will worship God for this. I will thank him and receive it with thanksgiving. And the beauty of thanksgiving is that thanksgiving can actually be satisfied. You can be content. Because what you were saying when you give thanks is, Jesus, in you, I have all that I need. And therefore, I don't have to come back tomorrow and look for something more thrilling, better, a hotter person, someone more deviant, something more thrilling, the way that sexual immorality will keep demanding and taking and taking. Contentment, we say, thank you, and I don't need more. I don't need better because I have you. I have the object of worship. I have the creator of sex. Therefore, I don't need to get it on my terms in my way to satisfy my covetous desires. And yet, it's still so attractive, right? Because it is half true. Like when sex tells you, hey, for this moment, it'll feel good. Don't try to tell yourself it won't. If you try to fight sin that way, you will not have success in it. Don't try to tell you, it's not going to feel good. No, it will. Don't try to tell yourself, no, I won't feel in control. You will feel in control. Don't try to tell yourself it won't be thrilling. It will be thrilling. But it's only half the story. And this passage tells us the other half of the story. Where does it actually end up? It says in verse 5 that you may be sure of this, that anyone who is sexually immoral and impure or who is covetous has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you. Let no one tell you that this is just okay and not a big deal. Because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. He's saying, yes, you will get momentary pleasure and you will forfeit an eternal inheritance. It will feel good for a moment and it will kill you. And it will take away the joy of an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. The place where real, lasting comfort will be found. Where there will be no more sin, no more pressure, no more stress, no more anxiety. The ability to rest because everything has been redeemed. Everything has been made new. And he's saying you could trade that for a moment of fake comfort. Or you could have it for all of eternity. That's where this is really going to lead you. It'll give it to you for a second, and then it'll take away your eternal joy. On account of these things, the wrath of God is coming. Okay, now, you thought I was weird already because of all this sexual immorality talk, and I just mentioned the wrath of God, which sounds extra weird to a lot of people. I don't have time to get into all the details of this, but the wrath of God is not the same thing as the wrath of people. It's not God's capricious anger, like he just gets mad at you the way your spouse gets mad at you or whatever else. It's God's settled opposition to everything that is unholy and unrighteous and evil. And when we take a thing that God created to be an expression of love, to be a way to give love to others, and we take it and make it about ourselves as a way to satisfy our covetous desires, God opposes that. God is opposed to it. And so it's saying that's on account of which the wrath of God is coming. Now, if you hear me say that and you think what I'm saying is, hey, you better not do this or else you're going to get the wrath of God, then I'm not doing my job. Because that's actually not what this passage does. It doesn't say the wrath of God comes on account of these things, and therefore if you don't want the wrath of God, you better stop doing it. Actually, look at verse 7 and 8. It says, therefore do not become partners with them. For, you don't want that punishment, do you? No, that's not what it says. For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. It's not so much, don't do this or else. It's more, the end of these things is this, and that's not you. That's not who you are. You were darkness. That was you. You're not any better than those people. But now you are something different. If you have trusted in Jesus, you are not that anymore. You are light. And it says that you are light in the Lord. Now, you got to think about this. Like, how does something that is darkness become light? Like, darkness in and of itself can't generate and transform itself into light. A dark room can't suddenly become light unless light enters into the darkness, unless light shines into it. And that's what's happened in the story of the Bible. When we come inward on ourselves, we create more darkness and we can't get ourselves out of it unless the light enters in. And when Jesus comes to earth, he introduces himself as, I am the light of the world. Jesus is the light that has entered into your darkness. And yet, though he was the one who perfectly gave, who didn't use sex as a way to get, but even abstained from it for the greater purpose of laying his life down. When he was on the cross, the sky turned dark, it says, for 3 hours while Jesus was on the cross. Why? Because darkness is a sign of God's judgment. And when Jesus was on the cross, he was taking the darkness, the judgment that we all plunged ourselves into, though he was the light of the world, in order that, though we are darkness, we could become light in him. That's how darkness is transformed to light, because the light has entered into our darkness and laid down his comfort. Jesus has laid down his control. Jesus has laid down the thrill-seeking appeal of sin so that we could actually be brought out of darkness and out of our slavery to those desires and into light. But what's interesting here is it's not so much that you've been brought out of darkness and into light, it's that you were darkness and now you are light. You have changed. Your surroundings haven't necessarily changed. The world's still going to be tempting, but you are now different. And so what he's saying is, because you are now a different person in the Lord, live differently. You're no longer a partner with the law firm you used to be a partner at. Therefore, don't partner there anymore. When your old boss comes calling and says, hey, we got a big case, we really need you to take it, just say, I don't work for that law firm anymore. I'm not a partner there. And what do you do instead? Now you try to discern what is pleasing to your new firm. And that's where verse 10 takes us. It says, try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. If you are now light in him and you walk as a child of the light, you live as who you are, you're trying to discern. Now my question isn't so much, how can I satisfy my covetous desire for control? How can I satisfy my covetous desire for pleasure or comfort? How can I satisfy my covetous desire for thrills? It's how can I satisfy my Lord? Because he's now the thing I love most. He's now my desire. And if you want to do that, there's good news. It's not actually as hard as it sometimes sounds. Like, discern what is pleasing to the Lord. And there's all kinds of books out there about how to discern the will of God. And you think it's this really mysterious prayer and God has to give you signs and that kind of thing. Okay, there are gray areas in life that are harder to discern. But the good news is God has actually spoken to us in the Bible. And here in this passage, he's given us some really clear ways to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. And that's the question that we're asking about every area of life. And so about sexuality, the question is no different. What is pleasing to the Lord in sexuality? And he says here that sexual immorality not even be named among you. So here's an easy test to decide if something is pleasing to the Lord in the way you handle your sexuality. First, you can ask about a particular thing that you're thinking about doing or a thought you're thinking about entertaining. Is this sexual activity? And then the second question, is this my spouse? Am I married to this person? If the answer is, yes, this is sexual activity, no, this isn't my spouse, then you can discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Don't do it. Abstain from it. That's easy, right? Now, I get it. Some of you are like, well, what counts as sexual activity? Okay, and well, what about marriage? We're married in our hearts. No, that's not what marriage is, okay? Not true. So discern. But the point is, if you really desire to please the Lord, if you're looking for a loophole, okay, you can try to find one, right? You can make a weird argument and maneuver your way out of what this passage seems to clearly be saying. But if you really want to please the Lord, I actually don't think it's as difficult as a lot of you think it is. Now, I can't get into the details of your life and tell you, you know, if you're dating your girlfriend, how far is too far. I can tell you that it's probably further back than you think. And the point is, This passage is not answering all those questions for us because it's encouraging us to adopt a heart posture that says, my desire here is not, how can I get as close to the forbidden line as possible without having to deal with the guilt of going over it? So what's the most sexually we can possibly do without breaking the rules? That's not what this is encouraging. It's saying, discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Make the goal total purity and go from there. Now, not all physical activity is sexual, so there may be some kinds of contact that you can handle that don't go into the area of sexual activity. But the point is, discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Make that your goal, that sexual immorality not even be named among you or in your relationship. So you need to be talking about that with other people. Talk about that in your community. I can't answer all the questions from up front today, but come talk to me afterwards. Go talk to your city group leader. Talk to some trusted Christians and say, hey, I've been talking with my boyfriend or girlfriend. I've been talking with this person that I'm spending time with, and this is what we feel like is appropriate. What do you think? And if they look at you like, no, where did you get that idea? You know, like that's a good corrective on you. But if you try to figure it out for yourself, you're probably going to be drawing the line in some strange places. And just be open to the possibility that this may mean doing things that seem weird, that are going to make friends of yours say, that's weird. For example, I was in the car yesterday and I was talking with a friend of mine about some steps that my wife and I took when we were dating or engaged to help keep us from sexual activity outside of marriage. And he told me, are you serious? Like, that's weird, you know? Like, I know people in this church who have committed to they're not going to kiss until they're married or until they're engaged. Now, I'm not saying to you, you have to do that or you're sinning, okay? I'm just saying that's an example, and I think it's a good example. There's some people who have committed to, we're not going to spend time alone together in each other's houses or each other's apartments when nobody else is around. If we want alone time, let's go to a park. Let's go out to dinner. Let's go grab coffee together. But let's not put ourselves in a situation where sexual immorality might be named among us. Now, again, I know, that sounds really weird. That sounds really repressive. That sounds goofy. What are you, a Puritan? Okay. It makes sense, though, in this passage that it would sound weird. It's saying the whole world is united in rebelling against God, and now he's pulled you out of that and made you light in him. And now, instead of partnering with them, you're discerning what is pleasing to him. Yeah, of course it's going to look weird. Of course it's going to look different. Don't be afraid of that. Don't be afraid of looking weird. What is the higher priority? What is the higher goal? Not looking weird or discerning what is pleasing to the Lord. Discerning what is pleasing to the Lord is the only thing that will lead to real joy because he's the only true God, not your covetous desires. Don't give in to those. Discern what is pleasing to him. In fact, sometimes it can look so weird that it even becomes attractive, that it even makes people start to notice and say, there's something different here. And actually, though it looks weird, it kind of smells right. It kind of seems like maybe that's the way it's supposed to go. And that's the last thing we're going to talk about today, is the third way to live as the light you are is to transform the darkness. So what should you do instead? We've been talking a lot about what not to do. We said, respond instead with thanksgiving. And what does that look like? Verse 11 begins to answer the question for us. It says, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead, here's what you do, expose them. What does it mean to expose the works of darkness? Well, verse 12 quickly clarifies for us that it doesn't mean we just talk about the works of darkness a lot so that we can make it clear what they are and have a nice list of them and expose all of them. It says, it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. Again, it's kind of like the sexual joking we were talking about. We shouldn't be saying, I'm not going to do sexual immorality, but I'm still going to talk about it in such a way that basically says this is really fun, and if it wasn't for Jesus being such a killjoy, we would all do this too. We want to talk about sex in a way that's consistent with how the Bible talks about sex. So it's not saying never speak of sex, but it's saying talk about sex as a good gift from God. And talk about sexual immorality for what it is. It's sexual immorality. It's not fun. It's not going to lead to life. It's not going to deliver the things that it promises. It's a lie. It's false joy. It's a counterfeit. And one of the ways we see that we talk about it in verse 13 is that we make it visible, right? It says when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. And so the idea here is more, don't be spending your time talking about the sexual sins of those outside of your community and how interesting they are or even how evil they are. Spend time exposing the sexual struggles of your own life, bringing those into the light. The reality is many of you struggle with sexual immorality. It's either a major part of your past, it's a major part of your present. And you may be in this room today and that is true of you. In fact, I know There are people in this room today who that is true of, and that we are all still, in some measure, struggling with it, myself included. And the worst thing you can do for that is not talk to anyone about it. Just keep it in the darkness so that it's never exposed. It says it's when we bring it into the light, when it becomes visible, that verse 14 says, anything that becomes visible is light. The only way the light can shine on it is if you bring it in, is if you let it out of the darkness. And some of you will not talk about your sexual immorality. You will not talk about your struggles. Either because you're ashamed of it, you think, well, no one could possibly accept me. That would just be weird or icky if I talked about it. Or because you are still trying to convince yourself that it's good. You're still trying to say, well, but it's not really sexual immorality. Just get it into the light. If it's not really sexual immorality, the people around you will say, no, you're just being crazy. Like, that's you're being over the top. But a lot of times you'll find that the people you are exposing these things to are struggling with the exact same things or have struggled with the exact same things. I can't guarantee you how that conversation is going to go for you as you bring that out. But my hope is, and my experience has been at City Light, at this particular church, that when I have brought those things into light, I have found a community of people who aren't saying, that's okay, don't worry about it. Because it's not okay. It's a work of darkness. It's not who I am anymore. And yet at the same time, they're not saying, oh, what's wrong with you? We don't talk about that around here. Maybe you should go somewhere else. They're saying, that's not okay. And I'm with you, and I want to fight it with you. And that's how Jesus handles our sin. He doesn't come in and say, that's okay. It's not okay. But he says, I'm with you, and I'm going to fight it with you, and I've already paid for it. You have something better in the light that you now are in Jesus. Let's do this together. So you need to bring your struggle into the light and let it be seen by others. And don't let this week go by without doing it. Talk to me. We're going to have people in the back after the service to pray with you who would love to talk to you about it. Grab some people from your city group this week, a few people of the same gender, and just say, here's the story. Here's where I've been. Here's where I'm at today. I want help. I want to expose this. I want to bring it into the light. Here's the funny thing. God already sees all of it. Like, who do you think you're hiding it from? And instead of condemning you, he's entered into your darkness through Jesus. God accepts you today, seeing all your flaws. So just admit it. Just confess it to other people, because they're the same recipients of that grace with you. And you know you have God's grace even in it. But the second way that we expose the darkness is by being the kind of community that is living in the light. It's confessing it, honestly talking about it, not talking about it as though it's no big deal, but talking about it seriously and honestly about sex and about our struggles. And it's also, as we repent, as we walk in purity, it exposes the counterfeit for what it is. Fool's gold looks like real gold until you put it next to real gold, until you have something to contrast it with that shows you that's just a fake. There's a scene in the movie Good Will Hunting where Robin Williams' character, he's a counselor, and he's counseling Matt Damon's character, Will Hunting, and he's doing this kind of thing with him. He's presenting a contrast to Will's life, which looks good but is actually kind of a counterfeit with what real love looks like. This is what he says. He says, if I ask you about women, you'd probably give me a syllabus of your personal favorites. You may have even been late a few times. But you can't tell me what it feels like to wake up next to a woman and feel truly happy. You're a tough kid, and I'd ask you about war. You'd probably throw Shakespeare at me, right? Once more onto the breach, dear friends. But you've never been near one. You've never held your best friend's head in your lap, watched him gasp his last breath looking to you for help. I'd ask you about love. You'd probably quote me a sonnet. But you've never looked at a woman and been totally vulnerable. Known someone that could level you with their eyes, feeling like God put an angel on earth just for you, who could rescue you from the depths of hell. And you wouldn't know what it's like to be her angel, to have that love for her, be there forever, through anything, through cancer. And you wouldn't know about sleeping sitting up in a hospital room for 2 months holding her hand, because the doctors could see in your eyes that the terms visiting hours don't apply to you. You don't know about real loss, because it only occurs when you've loved something more than you love yourself. And I doubt you've ever dared to love anybody that much. He's contrasting. This is what real love looks like. It looks like a soldier holding his friend's head in his lap. It looks like someone sitting up for 2 months in a hospital room holding his wife's hand, where the sex isn't thrilling and amazing and incredible, but it's love and it's sacrificial. Now you hear that picture of love. You're going to compare that to a computer screen? Compare that to a fantasy? Compare that to an affair? Compare that to a different hookup every night of the week? It's a fake. It's not the real thing. The real thing is sacrificial love That is what God created sex to be a picture of. And sex isn't even the only way to express it. You know, he mentions here the military. Like, don't even be thinking, well, once I get married, then I can have this great experience. You can do it now. Lay your life down for other people. As we are a community that says this relationship, this community is not about me getting what I want to satisfy my covetous desires. It's about me laying my life down for the people here the way God has laid down his life for me. That's the real thing. That shows sexual immorality to be the fake, covetous junk that it is. As we are a kind of community, what if we were this kind of community? May we be. May we be a kind of community where sex in marriage is viewed as beautiful, as a good gift and a good creation of God. And yet, the single life is not stigmatized or seen as kind of second best or some kind of disease that needs to be cured. And if you just had sex in marriage, then your life would be perfect. No, sex in marriage is beautiful, but it's not as beautiful as the giver. We know that God is the one that we ultimately give thanks to and the one who we enjoy. What if we had that kind of relationships where marriages were honored, but the single life is not stigmatized? What if we were a community where relationships between people of the same gender even were not sexual, but were deeper and more meaningful and more loving than a sexual relationship even could be? Where people are honestly bringing into the light their struggles with sexual immorality, whatever that struggle is, right? Whether that struggle is from adultery to fantasies to same-sex attraction to pornography to whatever else, that those are the things that we're talking about and bringing into the light and exposing to one another and loving one another through them without accepting them, but accepting one another in the midst of that, where we have relationships that are deep in that kind of way, where relationships between the opposite gender are meaningful, kind, compassionate, and not exploitative, where the motive isn't, how can I get a sexual response out of you or get my needs met and my covetous desires met through this relationship? If that kind of community put next to the different girl every night of the week, pornography culture exposes it for what it is. It's a fake. And that's why our appearances matter. How our church and how our community as Christians reflects to the world around us matters. Because what God is saying here, see, we often think the best way that we can love the people, our neighbors, people outside of the church, is to become just like them. No, that's just a descent further into darkness. The best thing we can do is speak lovingly and show them a community of people that are living by something different, that are living for something else, that want something else, that are walking in the light. Now, the flip side of that is some Christians and some religious people think the reason we're so different is because they suck and we hate them, and therefore, let's go be different and tell them how immoral and how awful they are. No, the idea here is it's because we love people who don't yet know Jesus that we want this light to shine so that they will experience it. The invitation that our passage ends with and that we'll end with today is, awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Not arise and expose yourself so that Jesus can condemn you. Arise so that he will shine on you. And we have an opportunity to show that light in the way that we love one another. That's the kind of, the idea is, look at the people around you and love them enough to not want what they want, to not become like them, to live for Jesus so that they will see him as well. When sex becomes about satisfying our covetous desires, it never satisfies. It becomes a dark thing that becomes inwardly focused and broken. But you, through Jesus, that is not you. You are now light in the Lord. If we discern what is pleasing to him, then we can let that light shine, speaking honestly about it among ourselves, living in a way that is different in the world around us, so that people will see something different, see relationships being handled in a different way, and be drawn into that same light, where sex can be enjoyed as a good gift from God in marriage, or even God can be enjoyed as the thing that is better than sex if he doesn't choose to give it in marriage.